Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hey.
Jinx, you owe me a Coke.
Oh my God. Do you want mine? I have it right here.
No, it's okay. But you will get me that at dinner then.
Ooh, okay, fair. Done.
So Abby and I are recording midday, which is...
rare.
Yeah, very rare. It's an experience. I do like... it's good for a change, though. I do like it.
It is. And I like that we normally get, like, the kind of, like, relaxed, low-key vibes on the weeknights when we record. But, like, we got energy today, baby.
I got Saturday energy in me. I'm ready to go.
I am so excited. So... I'm going to get into this pretty quick, but before we do, just a couple updates.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Apple Dabbleson is at band camp.
Mr. Apple Dabbleson.
It's so cute. He's like doing Tai Chi and talking to musicians and shit. And I'm like, I just want to pinch your little cheeks.
That is so cute.
Ugh, I hope he's having such a good day today.
I do too.
The first day, maybe the second day, they had them like walk around barefoot and blindfolded to try to find this drum that was being played every few minutes to like feel their way.
Oh my God, my fears.
Right? But like, how cute.
That's just...
I'm like, Mr. Apple Dabbleson, just do all of the fun little band stuff.
I hope one of them had a GoPro on and could just see later.
Oh, yeah. Like the really slow, run into the tree, turn around.
Who hasn't?
Right? You know? I do that not blindfolded.
Correct.
So, that's been really fun and really cute to hear about.
A true crime update that I don't think we've talked about, but by now it's kind of old news. Miss Gypsy Rose is getting divorced.
Yes. I guess that D wasn't that fire? Question mark.
Or maybe Pete Davidson's D is. I don't know. I made a funny meme that I thought was hilarious. He put the D in the fire. I'm just saying. I don't know.
It's true. Davidson.
I don't know.
According to Ariana Grande, he's 11 inches. I mean, 2.5 minutes.
Oh, he had a funny special about that, too, yes. Where he was just like, so I'm always going to be a disappointment because the expectation is so
right.
So great now.
It's all Harry Potter, 9 3/4, you know, like.
Pete Davidson's got daddy issues. Yeah. She had mommy issues.
Who it's like it? Oh, my gosh. Match made in heaven.
So I don't know. I'm like, y'all would have a lot to talk about.
It's true. Damn.
I mean, different scenarios, but.
Bless up different scenarios.
But they both like poking fun at. There you go.
Kinda. I mean, Pete Davidson didn't have a hand in that tragedy.
Correct, but he certainly built a part of his career on...
Oh, that's fair.
talking that about fair. It.
Oh my gosh. So yeah, that's pretty much what's new. It's a good time. I literally took my meds today and feel like I'm bouncing off the walls. So I promised that I took them, but I'm also just stupid excited to do this case.
So Abby, I've been asking her, like, because she's like, it's going to be two parts. It's going to be two parts. And I'm like, okay, so what is it? She goes, can't tell you.
Nope, I won't. I refuse.
So you guys already know because you clicked on it and you saw the name of the episode. I have no idea.
No,
so,
you don't even know the name yet.
No, I have no idea what we're talking about today. I just know that it's two parts.
Do you want to get into it?
Hell yeah, I want to get into it. What are we doing?
All right. Well, hi, hello, and welcome or welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast, About Time for True Crime.
You guys.
It has been a while since I put together a case that I was truly like hyper fixated on. And I don't mean like all of them that we do, we wait for one to grab us so that we actually do a good job.
Yeah.
But I mean fixated on. Like I
love an Abby fixation.
Googled.
Oh, I love when Abby goes down a rabbit hole, we are in for a treat.
Yes, so thank you for that to my ADHD. I'd like to thank
the Academy.
My neurospicy. Yeah. but I believe I heard this case for the first time way back when from My Favorite Murder.
And it was okay, taking it back.
One of my like driving to and from the halfway house that I worked at for a while, like the commute that would get me out of whatever the shit that day was, you know?
Yep.
And this one stuck with me. I'll be real with you. It's going to suck ass. All right.
Ooh.
I get nauseous reading about it, and I have put together a lot of information from different sources. So it's kind of going to be like the onslaught of information that might be a little much today.
Wait, give me a hint. I want to see if I can guess it.
There are two.
Okay.
It's a serial killer duo, and they are considered to be one of the most sadistic serial killer duos.
Paul Bernardo, Carla Homolka?
Nope.
No. Okay, hold on. Man and woman?
Nope.
Oh, is it, oh, fuck me. What's their, aw, damn.
Well, before I confirm, I am just going to throw out a trigger warning, you guys. Just right off the bat, trying to keep it real. Giant trigger warning for sex crimes, assault, general creepiness, murder, torture, suicide, and more.
She's fucking doing the toolbox
killers. Yeah, I am. Yes. I'm doing the toolbox killers.
Oh, that's been on the list. Oh, okay. All yep. right. Oh, fuck.
Yep.
I mean, so, great, but...
Sorry.
Damn.
But this is where my head went this week, and I said, you know what? I'll follow this.
Pardon my French already. I mean, I know, listen, this is an explicit podcast. We talk about pretty intense things, so if we're drawing the line at fuck, this probably isn't the place for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'll try to be mindful.
No, here's the thing, you guys. I think that we will need a certain amount of dark humor to get through this. There is a lot of satire in this, and I hope you know, because there are parts of this that I get so viscerally upset by that the only way to get through it is to, like, kind of make fun of the offenders here. So it's going to be a lot. I'm going to say fuck a lot.
Especially, I can't help it. Especially as women who work in the criminal justice field. By the way, we don't represent our workplaces. We just, like, I don't know if anybody thought that. Like, this is our fun thing to do.
Yes.
Completely unrelated from what we do, but working in the system, there is a dark humor, sort of deadpan approach to things that you have to have, because as we always say, if you are not laughing, you are crying. So you got to be able to laugh at the shit of it and mm-hmm. laugh at yourself, and you have to find some kind of levity or it's all consuming.
Yes.
So please don't take that as disrespect. It's never meant that way, but it's a coping mechanism.
And truly, like, we laugh a lot about stupid things. Like, you'll see in here at one point, I set up, like, a scene, like a movie, like a little rom-com.
I love that.
It's supposed to be funny, but it's obviously not how it went down. And it's one of those that, like, if I can't laugh at that, like, if I can't make a silly little fun setup, I'm not going to get through the absolute horrific shit that these victims went through. And if they can go through it, we always say we can talk about it. So we're going to talk about it. And I'm so excited.
All right. I knew that was coming.
So I do also, before we get all the way in, I like to list our sources at the top. But before we get all the way into it, Allie and I always do just ask that you guys leave a follow, a like, a review, a comment for us. It always encourages us. If you do want to give, like, a little coffee to the pod or something, there's always a Venmo or PayPal in our link tree. And by the way, thank you to Tori for our fun little coffees today.
Tori, we gave you so many nose boops and forehead kisses. You have no idea. So
consensually,
thank you.
If you want. But once you say yes, they're going to come, like, flooding in. Just, like,
rapid fire. There it is. You know, that's how that works.
All right. So we also just like to list our sources up at the top so you can have the faith and confidence that here at ATFTC we do our fucking research.
That we fucking do.
Of course, we never give the extensive list in the audio file, but the full list of sources is always listed below in the caption or in a Google Doc, which will probably be this case because there's too many to fit. So just a quick little highlight reel. I did use a Peacock documentary called The Toolbox Killers. I used CBS, NBC, The Independent, LA Times, and of course more. And the rest are always down below, baby.
All right, let's do it.
Okay. So I wanted to start today's episode by posing a question.
Okay.
Do you think people can change? Do you think that someone who has been so sadistic, so horrifying, so disgusting, that just even hearing the things they did sent people into hysterics, put people on antidepressants, spiraled some even to suicide, do you think they can change?
Wow.
Frankly, I don't know if I do.
Oh, you're asking such a broad question, and there's so many things where I'm like, it depends.
Yep. And so here, one of our offenders, at least, there is a criminologist in this world who believes they have changed, at least one.
Okay.
I don't know where I stand with it still to this day, but we're going to talk about it because I think this is a good question to keep in the back of your mind while you listen to these episodes.
Well, and we're big, I mean, supporters of, if that's even a thing, but obviously we believe in rehabilitation.
Right.
But there are exceptions to every rule, and some people don't want to change.
No, and I think that anybody who wants to change can change. I also think that some things beyond that prevent it, right? Like, for me, I would love to not be anxious. I can go to therapy, I can take meds, and I can use all of my coping mechanisms and still be anxious because I have an illness. I'm diagnosed with this. But I can manage it well.
Right.
And that's change that I can handle. But will I ever wake up one day and just be like, huh, what a beautiful day?
100% entirely anxiety free forever.
Right. Doubtful. Right. So I think it's interesting because when we talk about Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris, otherwise known as the Toolbox Killers, we are talking about perhaps the most sadistic serial killer duo there has ever been.
This one has kept me up at night.
Yep.
I know I'm glad we're doing this during the day. Wow. We timed this right. Accidentally.
Yes. And the other thing here is, like, this case has been considered by people working both of these cases more disturbing than Charlie Manson. You know, in this court case, people ran out of the courtroom sobbing after hearing certain pieces of evidence.
It's like with Kellyanne Bates, when every single one of the jurors accepted the state's offer for mental health counseling.
Insanity.
Which is rare. Mm-hmm. And there's always a few that are like, I don't need that shit.
Like, I'm fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then likely they're not fine. But
yeah.
Situations like that, that just gives a sneak peek if this is a new case to you. When we say this is horrifying.
It's horrifying.
There is no other way to put that.
So today we're going to start with one half of our duo, Lawrence Bittaker. I'm going to talk about him a lot. I'll call him Lawrence. I'll call him Bittaker. The same with Roy Norris. He'll be Roy or Norris, like, interchangeably throughout the whole thing. But we're starting with Lawrence for a few reasons. First, this creates a fucking beautiful flow to this storyline. And really, that's, like, the primary reason. But second, Lawrence was definitely the brains of this operation.
Okay.
And I think for us to really understand what's going on with these two, we need to start with him first. Because Roy was more than excited to go along with it. Don't get me wrong.
But he might not have gotten there on his own.
He might not have gotten there on his own, but also he might not have dreamed so big.
Okay.
If you will. So Lawrence Sigmund Bittaker was born on September 27th, 1940. And I would like to say, with no disrespect to anybody who has Sigmund in their name now, that might be a red flag.
I know.
Sigmund, why the mommy issues? And we have them. Don't get me wrong.
Oh.
Lawrence was born to a teen mom in 1940. He was definitely unplanned and unwanted. And this wasn't a particularly good home for Lawrence, as you might imagine.
You feel for the child.
You do.
And that's very sad and upsetting.
Lawrence, you know, his mom was a drinker and she left a lot. And his dad was incredibly violent. However, while Lawrence was still quite young, some sources say an infant, others say like a young child, he was given up for adoption.
Okay.
And I don't know exactly how this happened. Again, the sources differ. I believe he was adopted from, like, separately from his older brother, I believe, but adopted by an aunt and uncle in the family. But I will say I've also read that he was dropped off at an orphanage. So maybe both are true. Maybe one is true, but I tend to go with aunt and uncle because that's what Lawrence later said in his life.
Okay.
So if he was dropped off at an orphanage, maybe they came the next day or something, or maybe it was just...
Yeah, both could be possible.
Right. So who knows? But they found him, and Lawrence's adoptive parents were seemingly good parents. They at least provided financially. They got his physical needs met. He had food, he had walls, he had a home, he had a bed. And Lawrence's adoptive father was in the aviation industry. So due to that, the family moved around a lot. So he never really had roots anywhere. And Lawrence recounts his childhood as rough. He says it was like being a renter in the adoptive home. He said his adoptive parents would provide meals, a room, and comforts, but he never really had any good communication with them. And he also said he, quote unquote, never had a birthday party, never went to one. And I'm like, well, I think there's lots of reasons for that. If we think about being born in the 40s and having an adoptive family that's moving around all over the place. But I get it. That's
lonely.
And
no offense, you grew up to be a serial killer. Fuck you and your birthday party. Anyway.
Right? Why do you want cake? So
you don't get cake.
As one can imagine.
No cake.
For a kid who felt disconnected from his family unit, traveled around a lot, and never really stayed put, Lawrence Bittaker grew up feeling isolated and abandoned. He felt like nobody gave a shit. And for that, I feel awful for whatever this 7-year-old is.
Yeah. You feel for the... Damn it. You know, you do feel for the kid, but that...
But here's the thing.
But other people grow up with that, and they don't do that.
Other people grow up, and dare I say, with worse.
Oh, yeah.
And turn out not, you know, the best person. Like, there's no Mother Teresa, but you're not a bad person. You're not actively hurting other people. You're doing your best, and that's right. All you can do. And here... I don't think we were doing our best.
Mm.
So Lawrence also was and remained absolutely batshit pissed at his mother for giving him up.
His biological mom.
He blamed her his entire life. He believed if she had kept him, he wouldn't grow up to be a monster. To which I say, do you remember the actual environment that you were taken from? Because that doesn't seem better.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like you'd be with a more abusive blood relative.
Correct.
I mean, and he could still even be with blood relatives that just didn't beat him like his dad did. But what do I know?
Ugh.
And who knows? Sadism starts as a child. And frequently, when kids are starting to piece together what sexual gratification is and what they like, and I know it's hard to talk about, but this does develop relatively young in children. Most kids that have, if I remember right from my books, most kids that have like kinks or sexual kinks, that kind of thing, they find this out in relatively early childhood, like think maybe 10 to 12. So that's pretty young. And I know it's gross to think about. And it's not like they know what's happening necessarily, but they're starting to piece these things together.
Yeah, but it becomes relevant later for them.
Yes. And as sexual sadism happens when kids are young and piecing those things together, and somewhere there's this mix up where sexual gratification and violence become intertwined. So something happened to this kid in his life. And now, do we know? Did he do that to someone else? And he was like, oh, I like this. Did someone else do that to him? We don't know.
Yeah. And a lot of times you can identify a particular event where it was like, before this, they felt one way. And after this, they felt this other way. Jerry right. Brudos is, I think, a good example of that.
Perfect. Yeah.
We covered, what, episode 98, 99.
It was so good, by the way.
Thank you.
But it's exactly that, right? With, so for a lot
shoes.
Of kids.
Yeah.
There's this moment of like, ooh, I like these shoes. I like the shoes. And then mom sets them on fire. And now I'm pissed and I still like the shoes. And this is a weird morph.
Yeah, but I hate my mom for doing that. But there's this weird attraction to her. And she's punishing me. But this was something that was very gratifying to
right.
me. So all these wires got crossed and now they're stuck.
Right. And so much like Jerry Brudos, I am sure there was a moment. We don't know what it is. And if Lawrence does, he never fucking fessed up.
Yeah.
You know, but we know that as a kid, he would be punished for certain things. And some of the punishments sounded rough, I'll be real. But really the worst of what I heard, and this is not to say it's okay, but the worst of what I heard was that he'd be forced to like lay down naked on a bed. And an aunt or the uncle or the adoptive parent would put cigarettes out on his back.
Oh.
And like, that's not okay. That's not healthy.
No, that's very abusive and traumatic. And
it is. But, you know, we also have Teresa Knorr, who's chaining her children up, and they don't hurt people for the sake of hurting people. So I struggle with this because, again, you feel for the kid. No abuse is okay for kids. But this is on the spectrum for sure of abuse, but it is certainly not the furthest we've seen for a man who does some of the worst things we hear.
Yeah, like this pales in comparison to what he will do later, but it could have been a starting point.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So between no stability, feeling isolated, moving around a lot, and not having any real social supports to help him process and tether to reality, Lawrence also had something else going against him. A stupid high IQ. And I know what you're thinking. Isn't that a good thing? Isn't being smart a good thing?
Organized offender.
This is not that story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lawrence had an IQ of like...
It's not Jimmy Neutron.
No. There's no Goddard, you know? There's Goddard, but like there's no Goddard.
Aww. So
as a kid, he was tested in like early childhood and had an IQ of like 138 or something, which is stupid high.
Dang.
For context, what people consider like a quote-unquote average IQ is 100, because the way the math works out with your age, that's sort of what it should be equaling to.
Mm-hmm.
So 138 is high. And I myself have been tested and I have a high IQ, like within the upper 90 something percent of people, and it's not that high.
So this is a very, it's very, very high. Smart. Yeah.
And it's not really that much of a blessing. You're just like, can I get a break from my brain, please?
Well, yeah. And intelligence doesn't always, you know, that doesn't equate to smart. So someone who doesn't right. have the highest intelligence doesn't mean you're stupid. It means, you know, there's right. different ways we quantify it, but yes.
And so Lawrence not only had all of this going on around him, but now he's also unchallenged, he's bored, and he's unmotivated. So what do you do? Arson!
Oh, right? Good.
I mean, you start off small. You start burning ants and stuff. And like, that's no big deal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. But then, you know, of course it never stays that way. Like, it's not that fun to burn three ants.
Mm.
Like, just one, you know? And by the time...
I could never do that.
Same. And by the time Lawrence was in his adolescence, he was already incredibly interested in torture.
That's way, 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 way too young.
In case you missed it, a quick trigger warning here for animal abuse. But
no.
He has recounted stories where as a teen, he'd get upset at home. And they had like animals that they took care of that were out back. And at one point, he took a pair of pliers and removed all of the teeth from one of the family's rabbits.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck him.
Yeah. And this is early.
I hate that so much.
But that's not all. Because Lawrence started sneaking out and he'd wander around the neighborhood. He'd like set an alarm for midnight and sneak out the window. And at first he was just sort of meandering and peeking in windows. And then he'd sort of sneak in. But then that wasn't enough for him. And he wanted these people to feel fucked with. He wanted them to feel violated. So he wouldn't take anything. He wouldn't do anything to them. But he'd move around their furniture.
Ew.
So that you know someone's been in there.
Didn't like Danny Rowling do that too?
I think so.
And it was just like, I want you to feel violated, but not quite sure how or why.
Right. It's like, I want to know why. I don't want you to know why, but yeah. I want you to know something's wrong.
Oh.
Yeah. And he would just sort of enjoy watching the sense that these people realized they'd been violated.
Mm.
It's really gross. And around this time, Lawrence was in high school, you know. He says he didn't have any friends, and I don't doubt that he had a hard time making or keeping them. I mean, like, moving around all the time is pretty hard. Usually being pretty smart as a kid isn't always the best for socialization. And also, like, he's a weird fucking guy.
And not only that, but I mean, he's growing up in the 50s where, you know, we always look at things through our modern lens. So much of what we have to communicate with each other did not exist. So
right.
you make a friend and you move. Well,
sorry,
unless you exchanged that. A number and those things didn't change at all in that time, or you have an address to write a letter to.
Right.
You're not really staying in touch. It's not like you can see their status on Facebook. Hell, you could see what your friend had for breakfast this morning. You just have to check your phone.
Right. But not so much right now.
No, not for this guy.
And I'm sure, again, that part of that was true. But he was socially adept enough to date a girl named Marianne.
Okay.
Marianne was the sweetest little Catholic schoolgirl. She had this blonde hair and these beautiful big blue eyes. And she always wore this little like cross necklace that she had, which we'll actually see come up as like a theme. Lawrence really liked cross necklaces, which was kind of fucking ironic, but what do I know?
Yeah.
But, you know, while they were dating, they were really active with each other. The two would hike up in the San Gabriel Mountains, and he was sweet on her.
Okay.
All right. He really liked her. And he said, I love you. And she said, I like you a lot.
Aw.
And he was like, well, that wasn't super satisfying, but, you know, what can you do?
He's a teenager, right?
Right, yeah.
That's just kind of sweet, though.
Right? And I will say, at one point, and I believe this was consensual, but I don't really have any hard evidence to say one way or the other. It just hasn't been talked about, like, another one of the violations.
Mm-hmm.
He did record, like, a makeout session that they had.
Okay.
But it was all audio recording, because it's the 50s, so it's all, like, cassette tapes and stuff.
Mm.
So... you know, it's just interesting. It became something that he clearly liked and he did a lot. But
recording.
Yes.
Okay.
But a lot of this started when he was a kid. But you know, like most high school relationships, it ended. You're a kid. What do you know about anything? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Lawrence says he didn't really take it that hard, but there are some interesting parallels we see with later victims that make me wonder if this rejection stuck with him more than he's willing to say.
Mm.
But, you know, he says it's just high school.
Okay.
But around the time he was 17, just before graduation, he got arrested for like an auto theft or something. So he gets arrested right before graduation, ends up not graduating high school.
Nice.
And ends up going to this place called the Tracy Dual Vocational School, which is pretty much just a juvie, you know?
Yep.
And while he was there, they did a ton of assessments, which, like, of course you do. You want to figure out what's going on. Juvenile detention centers are often really aimed at rehabilitation and figuring out where kids can still grow, because we have this thought process that kids can grow easier than adults.
Yep.
And in these assessments, they already determined that he was angry and disturbed. He was labeled a polymorphous perverse personality, essentially meaning that he could commit any crime whatsoever just for his own pleasure.
I wonder what DSM that was in.
Right.
Two?
Two, maybe. One? Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. No, it wouldn't have been three. That's too long ago. Yeah, probably two. But he also was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder and, you know, psychopathy.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't care. I mean, that kind of makes sense if you have no feelings. Like, you're not really going to feel any certain way about it, but he did not care.
Which is kind of, is a check in that box that they might be right on that. So,
right.
Okay.
So by 1974, we're fast forward. Lawrence is 34.
Okay.
He's done some time. He's been out. He does a lot of petty crimes, but he gets caught for some of them, not all of them.
Right.
And mostly just hangs out. And he's smart. So, like, the times that he gets away with it, it's not because he's not picking up ways to continue evade being caught.
Mm-hmm.
He just keeps learning, which isn't always better.
No.
So, he's 34. He's living in and around the Los Angeles, Hollywood area, and he goes into this grocery store called Ralph's.
Okay.
And he does his grocery shopping, but I'm sure for the thrill of it, he steals a couple of steaks. Mm-hmm. And the clerk follows him out, as he would. He'd be like, yo, bro,
you know, pay for those or
shit. Yeah. So he follows him out, and Bittaker reports that he doesn't know how it happened.
Okay.
But apparently he turned around and shoved his arm out. And this is a quote, apparently had a pocket knife in his hand and ended up stabbing this guy within like inches of his life.
I hate when I just take my hand out of my pocket and I stab somebody.
You're like, oh, no, I didn't know that I had a shank there.
And I, when you just almost kill somebody.
And it's like, where's the job well done?
And the last time that happened to me, I'll be honest with you, I was like, but I didn't mean it. You know what? I don't know.
Yeah,
it just is one of those.
It's like, I'm standing there, I'm doing it, but it's like, why aren't you stopping me? Like, you want this, right?
Yeah, I just, you know, where?
Fuck. This is where we're starting. So he stabs this guy within inches of his life, and it is a miracle that he survived it all, but he did survive.
Attempted murder.
Yep.
Okay.
Assault with a deadly weapon.
Correct.
If you will. So Bittaker gets sentenced to prison.
Great.
For a little bit. Just a few years.
You know.
Teach him his lesson. Slap on the wrist.
Yeah. I'm sure he was a model prisoner.
So he goes to the California Men's Colony.
That's
what they call it.
Sounds culty.
It does sound culty. But this is... Now listen. This is where Lawrence meets his soulmate, Roy Norris.
Mm.
So just a quick pin there. I'm going to give a tiny bit of background on Roy.
Okay.
Roy Norris was born on February 5th, 1948. Roy's childhood was a bit different from Lawrence's. Roy was conceived out of wedlock, but his parents married to avoid being judged and all that shit, as you are in the 40s. And his dad worked in a scrapyard. His mom was an unhappy housewife struggling with substance use. And Roy was in and out of foster care his whole life.
Hmm.
You know, there is no doubt in my mind that as a youth, Roy faced so many series of challenges. He faced certain neglect, certainly violence, and there are reports of him having been molested or sexually abused in the foster care system. And Something that I found interesting here, he did report that it was a Hispanic family that fostered him where this happened and allegedly used that to further promote some sort of bias against Hispanic people. However, I don't think any of our victims that we talk about here are Hispanic. So my thought is he must have taken this out on some of his earlier victims.
Oh, that we don't know about?
Well, Roy did some of his own shit before he got to prison. Obviously, had to get to prison. And so, it grew pretty quick. Like, around 16, Norris was with his bio family. This was one of the times he was, you know, reunited after foster care.
Mm.
And they had this, like, family party. And he went over to this female relative. My guess is a cousin. That wasn't confirmed. But she's 20. He's 16. So they're about the same age. And he starts flirting hard. He's, like, coming on to her. And she's like, ew, cousin. Yeah. No, get the fuck out. And she tells his dad, which was probably a bad idea. He certainly got the shit beat out of him for it.
Mm.
But, you know, it's interesting. Like, we have these nuggets where he starts growing here in this sort of assaulty, sexually charged way.
Assaulty.
Yes. And so after he got beat, Roy, as a 16-year-old, in true 16-year-old fashion, stole his dad's car and he drove up to some mountains. This was in Colorado. He came out to the LA area later.
Mm-hmm.
But he went up to some mountains and he tried to take his own life by injecting straight air into his vein.
Oh, wow.
Now, before he could permanently hurt himself, he was apprehended by police as a runaway. And as you might imagine, sent right the fuck back home.
As they did.
Yep.
And sometimes still do.
And when he got home, his parents were like, yeah, we don't really want you guys. We don't really want this marriage. So, like, the second that you're old enough, we're all just going to go, like, our separate ways. Yeah.
Oh.
So, like, really warm welcome for your kid who just tried to kill himself. Thank you.
But also, it's not like he wanted to be with them. So maybe right. There was an end in sight to be free of them.
Right.
But what an awful just childhood.
There's no hominess. There's no one there for safety or comfort. And he was really all he had. And like, Roy, unlike Lawrence, does not have a giant IQ. He's not stupid, but he's just a guy. And he's average. Big.
Yep.
He's muscly. He's tall. He's like 200 something pounds by the time he's an adult. And people call him just sort of this big oaf. You know, which is it's kind like of a mice funny and picture. Men. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Oh. And so that clearly was a very healthy environment for him. And Roy dropped out of high school and joined the army for a while. He did a tour in Nam, and he wasn't in active duty, but he was honorably discharged and he came back. And Roy was he was himself. He just kind of floated by afterwards, did a few different jobs, random things. But he really had this urge to assault women. He raped a lot of women. By the time he was arrested and sentenced to 3 years to life, mind you, he was already considered a serial rapist in the eyes of California.
This is Roy.
Roy. Yeah.
Okay.
And so after, I think, a series of like 3 rapes and assaults, he was sentenced to the 3 to life and sent to the California Men's Colony.
Mm.
So now we're going to unpin from Lawrence. And Lawrence had been there for like a year when Roy arrived. So I just want you to picture this with me because it's kind of a meet cute.
It really is. Oh my.
Okay.
Enter the rom-com.
So picture it. The lights, they're low. JK, they're fluorescents and they're flickering. But you are sick and tired of your same old life. You're wearing the same clothes every day, just feeling like another old Tuesday. You know, you lift weights, you might go to the library, you twiddle your thumbs, you sharpen your shank, and you go to sleep. But, like, where's the joy in that life, right?
And, like, what's the benefit of Tuesdays when the hosts of About Time for True Crime haven't even been born yet?
Right. It's like, ugh, boring.
Like, what's even the point then?
So, Lawrence is there, but, you know, things aren't all bad. You know, you get to do some extra stuff. Like, sometimes you can work in, like, the laundry room or the kitchen, and maybe it's, like, a good sloppy Joe day. You know, but also every now and then you get to do like extra fun stuff.
Mm.
So Lawrence was like, okay, all right. Am I bored? Sure. But is it cool that I get to make jewelry? Yeah.
I didn't have that on my bingo card for this. I did not think he'd want to make... Oh, maybe he'll make crosses.
He did actually make a cross necklace. But, you know, you're just in this, like, jewelry making class. And today you're really pumped because you're going to make some cross necklaces. They remind you of an ex. Kind of a creature comfort, you know? But then you look up and there's this new guy. And it's kind of awkward. And it's kind of cute. Like, your eyes match, but he's wearing the same outfit as you. Wild.
Cute.
And you look and you lock eyes in this place with the flickering lights sparking something more than just the fluorescent bulbs.
One of us has to change.
LOL, just kidding. It wasn't romantic. But they did for real meet in a jewelry making class. And they talked a lot. They got close during this. Lawrence later said that they just talked bullshit, but I don't really believe that. And the reason I don't really believe that is they met this other guy, Richard Shoopman.
Okay.
And Richard, I mean, he was in there too. He was in there for killing a young college-aged woman. And they made like this really cute trio, okay? But Shoopman said it was more than just bullshit. See, he said they would fantasize with each other. Like, they'd share their deepest, darkest secrets and talk about what they wanted to do to people when they got out of prison. So they would dream of having this like cabin or trailer or cave and just fantasizing about all the victims they could lure there to assault and rape and potentially kill, you know, just like daydream stuff.
Could you imagine being a fly in the wall? Like, as we sit here today talking about those conversations happening, imagine actually being present.
No.
Especially as a woman to just have sat there kind of like and not be noticed.
Yeah.
To hear just how little they thought of life and the lives of others and what they would inflict on people for their own gain. It's just, even hearing that conversation, I'm like, add a few years. Just Adam.
Well, like, I think you'll feel even more strongly the same way when you find out that also a part of these fantasy conversations, they decided they wanted to take a victim for every year of being a teenager. So they wanted a 13-year-old, a 14-year-old, a 15-year-old. You get the point. Yeah.
It literally is a bingo card.
Yep. Gotta catch them all. You know? And so Bittaker gets out as a skilled machinist in October of 1978.
Great. He's got a skill.
Probably. Due to stellar behavior, because there are no women to assault or rape in prison.
You don't say.
Yeah. And Roy, actually the same thing, just a few months later. So they have this like weird teacher-student dynamic, Roy and Lawrence. And Lawrence always wanted to be like a teacher role to people. Like, he always wanted some sort of authority. Like I know more than you do.
This is, okay, so Lawrence is George in Of Mice and Men.
Yeah.
And Roy is definitely Lenny.
Yep.
He's the big brawn.
Yep.
Not the brains of the...
He's the muscle.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay.
And so, in fact, actually, in that Peacock documentary I watched, Laura Brand, who's a criminologist, did a long series of interviews with Lawrence Bittaker. Actually, they even got really close. Like, she was in his will close. But that's a different story. She did always say that he liked to be kind of a teacher. So he would always, he would have this sort of authoritative role. Almost.
Yeah, because he had a complex and he thought he was smarter than you and he could explain it to you better so you'd understand it from him. Right,
because you silly little goose. That's not it.
Ugh.
The two are reunited and it feels so good. And Roy and Lawrence start hanging around. They make a plan and they get a big silver van. They actually had like a lot of needs for this van. And to me, this feels very U-Haul lesbian of them, which I really like. first and foremost, they needed it to have sliding doors. You know, so that you could grab victims and get them in and closed quicker.
So, yeah, they had, they were outfitting this car
to be everything. They also really needed the van to be, like, soundproofed. You know, for, like, screams and torture reasons. Just logistics. And they grabbed, like, a little police scanner so they could stay ahead of the game. But they also wanted it to be cute, you know? So they added, like, this big green shag carpet.
Oh.
And they added this folding bed.
What a biohazard. Just with the two of them in it, I can smell it.
Mm-hmm. That shag carpet probably crunched when you walked on it by the end. And so, you know, beyond that, they had their little folding bed and then they just wanted their stuff in it, right? They wanted it to feel homey. Mm-hmm. So they put in this toolbox of like torture weapons and they also had like a little cooler with, you know, drinks and beverages and shit.
As one does.
And like all of us who like to personify our things, they gave the van a name.
Mm.
Do you want to know the name?
Big Bertha.
Murder Mac.
Ugh.
So the three of them, Murder Mac, Roy, and Lawrence, would like go drive around. You know, first they were just kind of living their summer vacation montage best life.
And neither of these men are gay.
No.
They're just besties.
They're just besties. And a lot of people did call them like soulmates, which is really interesting. And not necessarily in a romantic way, but they even died like very close together. It was almost like they could not live without each other by the end of their lives.
It seems like, they were certainly cut from the same cloth. That doesn't mean that that's a good thing in the way that that expression is normally used, but that they were of this mindset and belief system that was so bad and wrong and immoral and rare that they found each other and it was like, I'm never going to find somebody who was as game
for this absolute horrific shit.
Like, no one is going to be as down with this as you are.
Right.
So this is it.
So they took Murder Mac lots of places. They would go see the San Gabriel Mountains and they'd find little trails and fire roads. They'd even find these really big, steep ravines. So the two of them would take pictures like they were on a family vacation. There's a few you can see of Roy like pointing to the ravine and Lawrence like out by one of the fire roads. And like you might think this is just like a cute little scrapbook moment, but they actually were sending messages.
Oh.
They took these photos and they'd send them to that friend Shootman from the prison who was still back incarcerated as sort of like a, hey, remember those plans? We're doing it.
And he could have said something. He could have alerted, but he's game. So he's not going to say shit. He's just going to wait for more pictures.
Right. Because he's like, oh, finally, like I'm getting something coming in, you know? So I'm an asshole. In my research, I said the message on the photos was don't let your dreams be dreams.
Oh,
it's just so hard. It's like a tummy ache in the making. So now that Lawrence and Roy were out, built their mighty steed, Murder Mac, and in every way but chose a victim, planned the assault at very best and the torture, assault, and murder at worst, they were ready to really actually live their dreams. The two would go out driving around, taking Polaroid photos. Dozens, hundreds even, of unsuspecting women around the Los Angeles area. Anyone who was dressed in a skimpy bikini around the beach or had on a short skirt in the grocery store parking lot, they would just snap a little picture. And it was planned to the point where they chose a Polaroid camera because they didn't want to have to go get the film developed.
Because they knew it was creepy and someone might actually pick up on it and they wanted the picture instantly.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, something that was interesting here was that since Lawrence was working as a skilled machinist, he was making good money. Keep in mind, this is 1970s. He was making like $1,000 a week, which would be just under $4,200 a week in 2023. I say 2023 because that's what the American Institute of Economic Research had as the most recent inflation adjustment.
Oh, okay.
That's a lot of fucking money. That's like $16,000 a month.
Am I jealous?
Yeah, because I am. But here's the thing. He didn't want to stay in a really nice place. He stayed in a motel. And he stayed in a motel specifically that a lot of people who didn't have a lot stayed at. So he would be able to give them beer and weed all the time. And he liked having this like fucking like little posse or something. There are always young women around, and it's not like they worshipped him or followed him. There was no element of that kind of like cult savory complex thing. But I think he just liked being the guy that could always be around young women and give them beer and weed.
Yeah.
But even more shocking than all of this was he wasn't mean to them. I mean, they were his neighbors. One of them, Tracy Pena, was one of the young adult teens there. I think she was like 19 when she was there. And she found out that she got pregnant, which was not planned.
By Lawrence?
No, I think this was just a random person.
Yep.
But she called her parents and she told them and it went poorly. Like either cut off or disowned poorly. And she's like sobbing and she hangs up the phone. And because it's before cell phones, so she's attached to a landline somewhere or like a payphone.
Yep.
She turns around and this would make my heart jump out of my chest. But Lawrence was standing there.
Mm.
And he goes, if you need anything, anything at all for this pregnancy, I will pay for it. So he helped buy the prenatal stuff. He helped take her to all of her appointments. He would pay for the medical stuff she needed to make sure this baby was safe.
What's in it for him?
I think he just had this really weird complex where he wanted to help teen mothers because he wanted a different outcome for himself or something.
Like his mom.
Right.
Yeah.
Like maybe if someone had been there to help her, she wouldn't have done what she did or something. And it's so weird because obviously there are so many nuances to people. But it's such an oddly giving place to come from.
If there's
to
truly
some women.
Yeah, to nothing, to get nothing in return. To be entirely selfless and
right.
A philanthropist, I guess, in that way. But in the same breath, had this been a couple of years later and that baby were already born, he'd probably kill the mom.
Oh, absolutely.
So what a just dichotomy there. Okay.
Yeah. So I find it interesting, especially knowing all of the money he's making. Like, I almost wonder if it was like, yeah, I got extra.
Yeah, but.
But it's weird, right?
He could have spent that on anything. It didn't need to be something to help and do good.
Right.
When that's definitely not his philosophy for life. So it's just, that's a really weird concept that he would be so giving in this one moment. And then what, a month later, he would kill somebody that likely looks just like her.
Well. We're going to get into that.
Yeah. Well, they're prepping for something, so.
And the time is nigh.
Mm.
So, it's a midsummer day. June 24th, 1979. It's a Sunday, and the beaches of Southern California were bopping. All right, and Roy and Lawrence were out to have a good time. Driving up and down Redondo Beach, which is further south than LA on the coast.
Mm.
So, I don't know if it was exactly 15 hours down, but it was noted that they'd been driving for 15 hours.
Okay.
Like around, sort of smoking weed, drinking, taking their gross little fucking Polaroids of unsuspecting women and girls on this beach.
Yeah, meandering around.
Yeah.
Kind of going up and down.
And they see this girl and she's fucking stunning. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they didn't know it at the time, but her name was Cindy Schaefer. And Cindy was beautiful. She had this beautiful blonde hair and it kind of did like the flippy out thing that everybody had in the 70s.
Mm.
And she had this really bright smile and she had these big blue eyes and just like the coolest beach Cali girl thing going on. She was so bright and kind. Cindy was 16. 16. And she tutored Spanish, algebra, and geometry when she was in school. She really wanted to go to college to study languages just like her mom did.
Aww.
And she was so sweet. And actually, the reason she was out on June 24th was she had left a church meeting just a little bit early from Redondo Beach and was walking back to her grandparents' house, which was just like a few blocks away.
Wow. Okay.
So, Ass Brain and Musclehead spotted her and decided they were going to grab her. They drove up behind her, rolled down the window, and opened with, hey, you want a ride? And she was like, no. And they were like, okay, you want some grass? Which is just the most 70s thing to call weed I've ever heard.
Aww.
But she said no because she's like a good little church girl and she's walking home. And so they said okay and they played along and they drove off. But they didn't actually drive off. They just drove up out of sight and then flipped around and parked the van on the side of the road that she was walking on.
How creepy.
And so then when she walked past, Roy got out, he grabbed her and he pulled her into the van.
Yep.
Now, she did let a little scream or two out before she was fully in. But later, Bittaker said, and the way I would have gone apeshit if I was in the room and he said this to me. But he goes, you know, not to blame the young woman in this at all. But had she been even slightly more aware of her surroundings, she would have been able to see what was going on around her. She made it easy in a way.
Oh, I want to just...
That was his, like, reflection time, too. This was later in his life. This wasn't, like, right after he got caught.
So, in a way, So yeah, we're not buying that, but what we always do is try to think of what we can learn, right? And how do we prevent this from happening again? And I think so much of our growing up, being a 90s, 2000s kid, where it was like, it was always stranger danger. That was like forced in because of that. And again, is it always a stranger? No, but in these times, coming off the 70s, 80s, 90s serial killer thing where we were like, what the hell was in the water here?
Yep.
You had to be head on a swivel. I mean,
every damn time.
Was danger always lurking? No, but did you want to be prepared if and when it was?
Yeah.
Abso-fucking-lutely.
And for everyone who grew up hearing these stories of people who weren't, because the world was a smaller place, it was kinder, or it was less easy to communicate to know where the shitty things happened, even. Like, that's a big wake-up call. So the fact that he'll even say shit like this is frustrating, but it's a perfect summary of the times. People felt comfortable. People felt safe. People didn't feel like they had to take note of every license plate on the side of the street.
Yeah.
But back to our timeline here. Once Roy had overpowered Cindy and gotten her in the van, they tie her up. And now, according to a journal entry that was included in a book called Alone with the Devil, Psychopathic Killings That Shocked the World, Lawrence kept a journal of these events, and he would sort of recount them in the moment. So during this one, he wrote that even though she screamed when being taken, Cindy quickly regained her composure. Bittaker wrote that Schaefer, quote unquote, displayed a magnitude state of self-control and composed acceptance of the conditions of which she had no control. She shed no tears, offered no resistance, and expressed no great concern for safety. I guess she knew what was coming. End quote. Later.
Or she was paralyzed in fear, and you took that as her acceptance when it was really fight, also, flight, freeze or fawn. She probably froze.
Also, like, you're fucking tied up and probably gagged. Like, what do you mean no fighting back? Like, what are you going to say to that?
What can you do?
Nothing.
Okay. So
later, by the way, Bittaker explains this as, quote unquote, not an adversarial environment. And I say, okay, fuckhead, you say that to the woman you bound, gagged, and kidnapped. How is that not an adversarial fucking environment?
Oh.
But anyway, Cindy laid in the back, duct taped and listening to these Home Alone villain looking asses say God only knows what for like almost 3 hours.
Home Alone villain looking asses. Yep.
They are. I mean,
I know.
But they drove and they drove and they literally drove almost 3 hours to go up to those San Gabriel Mountains that they had visited so often before. And when they got there, they had found the fire roads that previously they had cut the locks on a gate or two so they'd have undisturbed frequent access to these roads.
Yep. So all of that preparation they did and all of those photos they took to say, hey, we're like marking our spot here. This is going to be ours.
Yep. And later when Laura, that criminologist, is interviewing him, she asks him how he's feeling. And he says, oh, around this time he was really wound up, anxious and excited. And, you know, just a reminder, trigger warning here, it's going to get bad. Okay. Now, depending on if you believe Bittaker's journal account of that night or his aged mind's recollection after decades, one of two things happened. If you believe his journal entry from that time, Roy told him to go take a walk for about an hour so that he could rape Cindy. If you believe the decades later recounting, Lawrence told Roy so generously that he could go first since he did the work. And regardless of how you believe it happened, Roy did rape Cindy first, and Bittaker decided to quote unquote watch the van. And again, these assholes took turns, so they swapped places at least twice each. And during the second time that Roy was raping Cindy, she asked if they were going to kill her, and Nora said no. What breaks my heart and like genuinely had me sobbing writing this was that all she asked in return was that if they had planned to kill her, they'd give her time to pray first.
Oh.
And Lawrence fucking Bittaker heard this, laughed in her face, and said, there is no God here, only devils. And that's the last thing this 16-year-old experienced in her life. is this. When they were satiated, I guess, the two argued over what they should do with her. Roy was like, do we have to kill her? And Lauren said, well, no. But, you know, she did spend time with us and she knows what we look like. So, oh, that's right. You're a registered sex offender and this would be your third strike. So if we do that, though, we should just go turn ourselves in. Or, you know, of course, we have the option that we quote unquote don't like after all.
Huh.
And Roy had no arguing after that, because if we're in the land of the three strikes law, that means life for him.
Yep.
And he's on parole, so it's already not good. Lauren said that he would hold her while Roy choked her to death. But when Roy started strangling Cindy, she fought. And she fought fucking hard.
Good.
And it was a struggle for him. But when Roy looked at her and he saw that she was crying, he couldn't do it.
Oh.
He went over to the side of the road and threw up.
So there's some
humanity somewhere.
But there's like a shred of it and it's fleeting and it pops up, but mm-hmm. not above his own needs.
Desires, even.
Not yeah. above. Well, I mean, humans, we have that desire to be free.
Yep.
And he knows that he's at increased risk of not being free if she's free.
So I suppose after Roy probably, you know, wiped off his little face and came back, Lawrence was like, you hold on to her for a sec. I'll be right back. And he goes into the little Murder Mac van and he finds this wire hanger. And he comes back and he tells Roy, he goes, here, strangle her with this.
Why wouldn't he do it?
So Roy tries. He's trying to twist it. He's manually twisting this hanger and it can't get tight enough. It's not killing Cindy. So she is literally surviving.
Barely.
Through so many different strangulations for so long. And eventually, Lawrence just got pissed and grabbed a pair of pliers and twisted it until Cindy had officially died of the strangulation. Afterward, the two lay out a quote-unquote extra shower curtain that they had. Why was there any shower curtains in your fucking van? I don't know. But they wrapped Cindy's body in it before tossing her over the side of the ravine. According to Roy afterwards, Lawrence said to not worry about the evidence since the animals would eat it all. And to date, Cindy's body has never been found.
Oh, what an awful thing for her family. She was 16 years 16. Old.
16.
That poor girl.
And of course, this is their first murder as a duo. So nobody's suspecting anything is going on right now.
Yeah.
So nobody knows what happened. She just vanished off the side of the road coming home from church. And they probably
said she was a runaway.
I think they did at first. They thought she had gone back to like see her mom in Colorado. But after months had passed and they hadn't heard anything, people got so stressed. Because how could you not? I mean, I would be by week two. You know, like,
yeah.
But later, during one of the interviews that Laura did with Lawrence, she had asked why they picked Cindy. And verbatim, like I wrote this down word for word, Bittaker said, well, she was blonde and pretty and alone. And if that doesn't fucking explain why women are the way we are, well, fuck it. I don't know what would. But with Laura, Bittaker also downplayed a lot of his involvement. He'd make the victim sound more compliant than anyone else. Than anyone could be. Like, okay, this is no big deal. I don't like it, but we're stuck with it. It's like, I don't think your rape and assault and murder victim really thought, I'll just make the best of it.
This is Lauren saying that?
Yeah. One of the FBI agents who worked on this case at the time, Agent Ellen O'Connell, stated that he's just trying to manage the impression, which is something that happens a lot with people with antisocial personality disorder because they're so good at finding that mask and fitting in. That for him, it wasn't like, no, I want to help you figure out what happened. It's like, well, I want to, but also I don't want you to think bad of me.
Right.
So like, it wasn't that bad. She wasn't like against it.
So we have to blame her a little bit and then we have to.
Yeah.
Release. We can't have that heightened emotion. It has to be very even keel. Whatever happens, right. happens kind of thing. And so if that was the end result, then that was the end result. There's
I don't know what you mean.
No two ways to look at it, you know?
And so Laura asks, she goes, hey, you know, how did you feel after murdering Cindy? And Lauren said, I don't know. I just never thought of it.
Then what was the point?
Well, I think the point was rape. and torture.
You didn't have to.
But that's also not true. And we know that that's not true. And they know that that's not true. And everyone fucking knows that it's not true. Because everything Lawrence did was planned. He was a planner. He was a thinker. He was an IQ of 138. He's got the face of like an older mix of Macaulay Culkin, the Joker, and like a weird man who's made his living being a Christian clown to feel closer to God, or probably in this case, to feel closer to fucking John Wayne Gacy or something. And on top of all of that, this was beyond prepared. Like, I think the fuck not, Lawrence. I don't think this just happened. Because one of my favorite parts of this Peacock documentary was after recounting this, Lawrence had insisted, you know, he's not a planner, you know, and he didn't think, he just did it. And it was so funny because Laura's interviewing him and she goes, Larry, and he goes, Laura. And she goes, you can't say nothing was planned. And Bittaker goes, what? Because I bought a van means I'm going to go out and kidnap folks? No. And it's like, no, Lawrence, buying a van doesn't mean that. But soundproofing it, putting in a murder toolkit, a bed, and also a police scanner, and also having pre-chosen dump sites and written down fantasies of what you're going to do that you then carry out, says plan to me.
And then have a record of it by taking the photos of it and then like kind of gloating to your friend that's just not out of time out yet.
Yep. But he's not a planner. What, buying a van means he's going to go murder people?
He planned things better than me.
Right? And we're planners.
Damn it. I'm planning a wedding right now. Planning shit sucks.
Yep. So we get nowhere near long enough after Cindy that Roy and Lawrence found a new little thing.
So no cool down period.
On July 8th, 1979, a mere 2 weeks after Roy and Lawrence kidnapped, raped, and murdered Cindy Hall, they were back out on the hunt. Lawrence was feeling a little down. You know, he thought the first time wasn't really that fun. Boo. But, you know, he reassured himself. He went, okay, listen, probably just my first time. I need to work out the kinks. Like, it's not a big deal. We'll try again.
Ugh.
And Roy and Lawrence are driving around. And they're at the beach, just kind of hanging out, doing their thing, taking pictures. And they're near the Pacific Coast Highway. And they're driving down it and they see this hot little thing hitchhiking.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Andrea Hall. And Andrea was 18 and had been at the beach with her sister. I believe it was Julie. We hear from a sister named Julie, but I don't know for a fact if that was a sister she was with.
Mm-hmm.
But with her sister and her kids. And Andrea was going to leave a little bit early. And she was like, don't worry, I'm just going to go home. I'll see you there. Well, her sister didn't know she'd be hitchhiking. And so Andrea was hitchhiking. Andrea had this beautiful like wavy long blonde hair and just the coolest vibe you can imagine. Also very like Cali beach girl, but meets like a little bit hippie. There's one photo of her with this little halter top on, and I know that you know what this looks like in your soul, but she also has this big like butterfly necklace, and you just know she had a banging vinyl collection.
Oh,
you know. But well, Roy and Lawrence watched her for a while and they saw this other car pick her up. And they decide to follow the car.
What?
Because, you know, she's hitchhiking. Who knows? They might not take her all the way. And lucky for them, they didn't. So they dropped her off again on the side of the road. And she sticks her thumb out and they pull up. And
they're like, imagine hey. Being the people that picked her up before.
No.
That let her out. That probably had a pleasant conversation with her back when hitchhiking was so much more common than it is today.
Yep.
And you say, all right, well, this is as far as we're going in that direction. So... good luck.
Yeah. Well, this one was a little bit different too than Cindy, because they kind of made it look like Lawrence was the only one in the van. So Roy went back behind the seats and was like hiding in the back seat. So when he picked her up, or when they picked her up, Andrea looked in, she only saw Lawrence, and got in the front seat. And so Lawrence was like, oh, hey, just so you know, there's like a cooler in the back if you want like a beer or drink or anything. And so she gets up to go to the back of the van to grab the cooler.
And she just walked into Roy.
Yep. Who then immediately started attacking her. He had like this. This is really out of place and I get that. But this is really the only comparison I have. Do you remember way back in the 2000s during the iCarly days and Sam would have this butter sock? that she would hit things with. Like she put sticks of cold butter in a sock and she'd like hit people with it.
Yes.
It was like that, but like heavier. It wasn't butter. They put something else in like a sock pantyhose kind of thing.
Yeah, Roy, some people will do like change.
Yeah.
Or a lock or something like hard and metal.
Yeah.
So I say some people. I think I've seen that in cases before. I've got no experience with that. Like, let me say all that. My
street cred.
Jeez.
So it was something similar to that. I don't remember exactly what he put in there, but he hits her over the head with it.
Makeshift, yeah. That.
Yeah. And she obviously had no idea who was there. She was not expecting how this. How
surprised are you in that moment? And then how quickly does that turn to terror?
But here's the thing. Andrea's a fucking badass. And you know how I said Cindy fought back?
Yep.
Andrea fights back. All right. And Andrea, she's a cute little thing. But let me tell you, she gives this green gross giant a run for his fucking money. Like she starts winning at one point.
Really?
It's loud. Don't get me wrong. And they are in city traffic. So like people are around.
But it's soundproofed.
Relatively. And so Lawrence starts getting antsy and he's like, oh my God, like he's losing. It's kind of loud. Like there are people around. So he slams on the gas and then on the brakes and it throws both of them back into the back of this van. And this gives Roy just enough time to get back in control.
How terrifying.
Awful.
And she could have had it. Jeez.
She was so close. And there are like literally cars all over the place. Like there are so many people around.
You know, and that's the kind of thing too, where if we put ourselves in that position, even think of like another car driving by, even if you did hear something, what would you think of it, if anything?
Right. And would you? Because you probably have your music playing. I know for a fact Lawrence turned up the music in their van.
And then even further, would you be kind of annoyed?
Yeah.
Like, what? I don't want to listen to that.
Yeah.
You know, you just hear like kicking or something like that. And you're like, why would you... Like, is that the base of a song?
Grunts or something. And you're like, why are you fucking in the back of that van?
Oh, like, yeah.
You know, like there are other places your brain goes first.
That it should make you hyper aware, right?
Yep. Nope. So they do the same thing. They tie Andrea up and they drive and they drive and they drive another 3 hours into the San Gabriel Mountains.
Right back where Cindy was.
Yeah, a little bit further this time, though. Just to be sure, you know. And so they make Andrea do horrific things. I mean, like, truly horrific things. They have her posing for photos. They make her pretend she's enjoying it. They take these Polaroids. And, you know, again, it's so that they don't have to get the films developed. But they make a ton of these Polaroid photos of her. They have her posing, doing lewd acts, and the two took turns raping Andrea just like they did with Cindy. But this time, there was a slight scare with a car, like they saw headlights, and so they hit her, which I'm sure wasn't hard to do if you're in a van anyway, especially one that's been decked out to specifically be a murder mobile. But once the car was gone, they were like, okay, we're going to go a little bit further in just to be sure that nobody else is around. And they make her walk naked next to the car for like the mile or three that they drive up.
What?
And then when they get her there, they make her perform oral sex on both of the men, I think, but at least Roy. And once they had all their stupid fucking orgasms and photos and more fucking photos, Lawrence Bittaker was like, okay, I want you to take... You know, put your hands up this way, do this thing. And the most sadistic thing I've ever fucking heard, which is when he was done, he goes, hey, I'm going to kill you. And then he takes a photo the second she hears that. So he has a photo of her face as he says this.
Knowing that she's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
And when Roy and Lawrence decided it was time, they decided to try something they'd seen in a movie once. You know, switch it up a little since the suffocating didn't work super well, you know. So they take an ice pick and they jam it in her ear. And for those of you who might not know, this is not an effective, efficient, easy, quick, or painless way to murder someone. It's torture in and of itself. This would first puncture your eardrum, which would cause confusion, probably make you really dizzy, definitely damage your hearing, and you'd probably be hearing that loud pitch like the that people with vertigo get, but like blasting in your head. And the other thing is, yes, if you drive an ice pick far enough into someone's head, it might hit their brain. But how long does an ice pick have to be to get all the way through the brain to a point where it's fatal? Because it wasn't as long as their ice pick was. So Andrea is living like this for a while. Like 20 minutes maybe before Lawrence decides he's just fuck it impatient and he's just going to strangle her.
I don't have words.
And when Andrea was finally out of her suffering, the two did the same thing they did with Cindy, wrapped her body up and threw it into the ravine. And just like Cindy, to date, Andrea's body has never been recovered from the San Gabriel Mountains.
Do we think it's just from animal activity?
Yeah. Yeah. They had later on like a little glimpse. Both Roy and Lawrence at points have given maps to where the bodies would be, and they can't find anything. So it's been long enough. They're assuming it's just decomposed. But later in interviews, Bittaker said that, you know, he's never had any sadistic behaviors. Except that very narrow one I just told you about, meaning the photo.
That's it? Yeah. That's the only thing he deems as sadistic.
Mm-hmm. He's never had any sadistic behaviors. I don't know what you're talking about.
So the ice pick didn't count?
No.
Or no, any just, of the other... Okay.
He was just trying something he saw in a movie.
How old was Andrea?
Andrea was 18.
So these are young girls.
Yeah. And well, that one must have done it for them for a while because it actually led to a real cool-off period for Roy and Lawrence. Beyond 2 weeks this time. The two enjoyed their summer bromance, driving around, snapping pics of skimpy-dressed girls, and Lawrence would work at his super fucking lucrative job for some reason. And then they'd take the photos that they'd taken of the girls and of Andrea and Cindy, and they'd each have them for a while, and then they'd trade them like fucking Pokemon cards. You know, because like you get tired of the same ones.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I'd be like, did you Clorox that thing, or...
What in the world?
But it wasn't until September of 1979 that the two picked up the next two hitchhikers.
So we're a few months later here.
Yes. And their next two hitchhikers were a 13 and a 15-year-old hitchhiking a block from the beach.
No.
But we'll get there next week.
Oh, fuck you.
Sorry, I mean, sorry.
I could use a break. Yeah, I will we need say a that. Break. But wow.
Yeah. So this one sucks ass, huh?
So we have mental health resources linked in our Instagram
so
page.
So many fucking mental health resources linked. Next week, just so you all know, we're going to get into Roy and Lawrence's last three victims, the court case, and the aftermath. I'll be real. This week is hard. Next week is harder. But there is a light at the end of the tunnel. We'll get through it together. And if these girls had to fucking experience this, they deserve the recognition that they got through it to a point where they fought for their lives. And we can fucking deal with listening to it. It's so tough, but it's so powerful. And again, we don't victim blame here. None of these girls deserve any of this. But Allie and I do always try to take something away. Something we can learn. And while we can, we literally will white knuckle onto anything that reminds us of humanity and keeps ourselves sane. So if this says anything, just communicate. Tell people where you're going. Tell people the path you're on. I know that hitchhiking, at least in the States, is still illegal, but if you're going to do it, just exercise stupid fucking caution. Send a partial plate. Send the vehicle you're getting into. Text your friends. Have a FaceTime video going when you're in a Lyft. I don't care. But just communicate and don't be alone.
Share your location with somebody that you trust, even if it's just a brief moment right. to get where you need to be.
You can do share for an hour. Apple does that. But your life is worth way more than the cost of that lift.
Absolutely. It's 100% of the time.
So we love you guys. Please stay safe until next Tuesday. next week's gonna suck, but then we're gonna dance on both of their little graves. So don't worry about it too much.
Well, thank you for doing that. And thank you guys for tuning in. We love and appreciate all of you who are listening. If you liked the episode you just heard and you've liked any in the past and you'll want to keep hearing them in the future, please give us a follow.
Yes, please.
Don't forget to rate, review, download, share, and tell a friend. If you repost anything on our Instagram page, please tag us or send us a message. We would love to shout you guys out in an episode. And yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you guys wanted to see the pictures of these people, which the women, absolutely, they're all gorgeous, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend looking up Florence Arroy.
They're nothing to fucking look at.
No.
By the way, just no. Not that it matters, but you know.
Genuinely, I think my mix for at least Florence of like Macaulay Culkin, the Joker, and like a weird guy who made his living as a Christian clown feels very accurate.
Yep. No, I know the one you're talking about, and I saw it, and that is a good description.
But if you needed to see for yourself, which I get, you can always do that on our Instagram. That would be at About Time for True Crime Pod with periods in between every word. So that is ABOUT period, TIME period, FOR period, TRUE period, CRIME period, POD because podcast was too long. But if you, like Instagram, wanted to send us something too long, you could do that to our email. As long as you're not creepy, we'll respond. But I'm going to let Allie tell you where that is because my tum-tum hurts and I need a Pepto-Bismol after this.
So if you wanted to send us an email, you could do that to abouttime4tc@gmail.com. So that's ABOUTTIME, numeric4tc@gmail.com. Please send us your case reviews, thoughts, feelings, pod pets, you name it. We'd love it. And we'll see you next time. So if I take a look at my clock, that was
About Time for True Crime.
Bye.
Call your therapist.
Bye.